Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
After all the speculation, Governor Rick Scott makes his decision on a sweeping and very controversial education bill.
House Bill 7069, it's going to be good for our students, it's going to be good for our teachers, it's going to be good for our state.
Also this week, the Florida Senate gets its state worker raises, but it had to agree to the House's retirement overhaul to get them.
Would it be fair to say that the House wouldn't agree to the changes on public employee pay raises without the inclusion of this language into this bill?
It would be fair to say that.
We'll also find which of several gun bills finally made it through the legislature this year. And we'll also get an update on a cross-Florida natural gas pipeline. Oh, and we'll also check out some political statements meant to be worn. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Governor Rick Scott has approved a new law requiring school districts to share some locally generated and federal funds with public schools. But the fight over the measure may not be over yet. We get more on that story from Lynn Hatter.
House Bill 7069 is massive. It covers everything from recess to charter schools to testing and more. And now it's law. For the Miami-Dade School District, that new law means millions of dollars in lost revenue.
On the capital outlay piece, direct impact on Miami-Dade this year if House Bill 7069 passes or is approved by the governor. $25 million direct transfer from the traditional capital outlay pot over to charter schools. A year from today, $40 million impact. 2 years from today, $62 million impact.
Miami-Dade Superintendent Alberto Carvalho blasted the measure last month before the State Board of Education. His concerns are shared by school districts across the state. That's because those districts will have to share a portion of the money generated locally for construction and maintenance with charter schools. And when it comes to federal funds for low-income students, those dollars must now follow the student instead of being held in the district office. Charter Schools USA lobbyist Chris Moya says the changes help bring parity in school funding.
And that philosophy is a really simple one to understand. If the child generated those dollars for their education, then the dollars follow the child to whatever public school they go to. That's the basic concept.
Since their inception, charter schools have received less funding overall than their traditional school counterparts, but now that's likely to change, and the charter industry can also expand even more. The new law allows them access to a pot of money if they set up near failing public schools. It's the priority of House Speaker Richard Corcoran, who touted the program during a bill signing with Governor Rick Scott.
We have kids in Florida who are stuck in failure factories from their first entry into public school all the way to the end. And this is the beginning of the end of that. And now we're going to give those kids schools of hope. We're going to give them a chance to go out there, get a world education, and thrive.
The idea remains controversial, and it's unknown whether any charter schools will take it up. Moya says it's a decision that will fall to individual charter companies. In addition to the big wins for charter schools, the state also included more money to expand a scholarship program for children with disabilities. And the new law tweaks the state's standardized testing system to remove the Algebra 2 end of course exam. Elementary school students will be entitled to recess. And Governor Rick Scott calls the new law a win.
House Bill 7069 is going to be good for our students. It's going to be good for our teachers. It's going to be good for our state.
But the law's future is still uncertain. Some Republicans, many Democrats, and public school education groups pushed for a veto. And charter lobbyist Chris Moya says he still thinks the issue could land in court. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
State workers are in for a raise after Governor Rick Scott approves a sweeping measure earlier this week. But Nick Evans reports the pay bump comes with a trade-off.
The past few days haven't been great for the Florida Senate's priorities. Senate President Joe Negron's higher education overhaul is dead after Governor Scott chose to veto the measure. But the governor did sign off on a package of state worker raises.
Florida's state employees and law enforcement deserve to be rewarded for their hard work, and that's why I'm proud to be here today to sign Senate Bill 7022, which provides pay raises to state employees state law enforcement, and correction officers.
Here's how the increases stack up.
Most state employees will receive either a $1,400 increase if their current salary is below $40,000 a year, or a $1,000 increase if their salary is above.
That's Clearwater Republican Jack Latvala speaking on the Senate floor last month. And the Appropriations Chair says the raises are even better for law enforcement.
Law enforcement will receive a 5% increase in salary. Most correctional officers will receive a $2,500 bump in salary, which, depending on how long they've been around, could be close to 10%.
But that comes with two significant caveats. The state group health insurance plan will begin moving toward a four-tier system, and most public sector employees will default into a 401k-style retirement program.
Up until the effective change of this bill, if you didn't select one of the options within the first 6 months, I think it is, then you got put into the defined benefit plan, the traditional FRS pension plan. With the change in this language, you now have 9 months to make a selection. If you don't pick anything, you get put in the investment plan.
The pension plan is generally seen as the safer long-term investment because benefits are guaranteed. For instance, the bill carves out law enforcement and correctional officers. They don't default into the investment plan. Under the 401k-style program, workers vest more quickly, making it easier for short-term employees to carry retirement savings from job to job. But the payout depends on how much an employee puts in, and that nest egg isn't insulated from fluctuations in the market, which could be good or could be bad. It put Democrats in a tough spot, having to decide whether to accept trading their retirement changes for employee raises. Here's Lake Worth Democratic Senator Jeff Clemons speaking with Latvala.
Would it be fair to say that the House wouldn't agree to the changes on public employee pay raises without the inclusion of this language into this bill?
It would be fair to say that.
Clemons wasn't willing to make the trade. In the end, only four Democrats were. Many fiscal conservatives look at state pension programs as massive and growing liabilities. Moving public sector employees out of defined benefit programs is seen as an economic imperative for lawmakers down the road. But a 2016 report from legislative researchers shows the main pension fund generally exceeds expectations, and its long-term returns are in line with funds from other large states, like New York, Texas, and California. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Just in case there was any doubt, it would seem Florida's employment situation just keeps getting better. May's jobless rate, announced this morning, was down 0.2 percentage point from April to 4.3%. That means out of a total workforce of just over 10 million people, fewer than 500,000 Floridians didn't have a job in May. The rate is the lowest it's been in Florida since August of 2007 and matches the national unemployment mark. Florida's lowest unemployment remained in Monroe County, which includes the Florida Keys. They came in at 2.7%. Hendry County in southwest Florida had the highest jobless figure at 6.6%. Still to come on Capitol Report, a new law creates mandatory minimums for trafficking fentanyl. Some argue the rules are too stringent, but others argue with a drug so strong, they have to be.
No addict is going to be in possession of a trafficking amount. If you opened that and it was airborne, we would all be dead right now.
Gun rights supporters and gun control advocates weigh in on how they fared this past legislative session.
I understand and know firsthand how devastating it can be to families that are suffering these senseless tragedies over and over and over again under these existing gun laws.
It's been a year after the Pulse nightclub shooting, and the FDA still hasn't lifted its ban on actively gay men donating blood.
I really think it's still, there's a stigma about HIV, and I think there's a lot of fear about it. There's really no scientific basis for this.
And we'll check out historic Florida artifacts representing decades of political campaigning and marches on the state capitol.
We've got them in various displays. They're folded, they're hanging, they're everywhere.
Under a newly signed Florida law, possession of only a small amount of the synthetic drug fentanyl can land a person in jail for a minimum of 3 years. Regan McCarthy reports some are pushing back against the mandatory minimum sentence, but others claim it makes sense when one considers that same small amount is enough to kill a room full of people.
Florida is facing a fentanyl epidemic as the number of overdoses from the drug skyrockets. And Attorney General Pam Bondi says the drug is extremely dangerous.
This is black market fentanyl. This isn't the fentanyl that's being administered to cancer patients, to surgery patients. This is the black market stuff. It's being manufactured in Asia, and it's coming in through the traditional smuggling routes, Canada, but mainly Mexico, into our country and into our state.
Bondi is applauding a bill signed by Governor Rick Scott that cracks down on the trafficking of fentanyl and puts mandatory minimum sentences in place. And Florida Sheriff's Association President Jerry Deming says the measure gives important new tools to law enforcement.
That is where we want to better hold accountable drug dealers who are peddling fentanyl and heroin and any mixtures thereof that causes people to die throughout the state of Florida.
But the measure has also gotten pushback from people who have raised concerns about implementing new mandatory minimum sentences. That debate led to a back and forth between the House and Senate during the legislative session. Senators voted for a version of the bill that did not contain the mandatory minimums, but the House put the sentences back on and returned the bill to the Senate. With the end of session looming and pressure to get a bill on the books mounting, senators accepted the change. But Lauren Crisai, who works for a libertarian think tank called Reason Foundation, argues mandatory minimums aren't effective. She says looking at heroin abuse shows that.
The arguments that are always made by legislators is that we need these laws to serve as a deterrent and to prevent people from doing these things. But if the prison population today is 63% have never been to prison before, clearly that deterrent factor isn't working, right? And with this heroin epidemic that has sort of exploded over the past few years, it certainly hasn't reduced drug use either.
Instead, Crisai says mandatory minimums tie the hands of judges, taking away their discretion and often saddling offenders with heavy sentences.
In Florida, the people who can get caught up under these laws and have with the mandatory minimums for prescription opioids are not high-level dealers. They're people who it's their first time in prison and they've bought a handful of pills. And we have dozens, if not hundreds, of examples of that happening there.
Attorney General Pam Bondi disagrees, saying the bill will work to target dealers.
No addict is going to be in possession of a trafficking amount. If you opened that and it was airborne, we would all be dead right now. That's how lethal and how large 4 grams of fentanyl is for a trafficking amount. 2,000 to 6,000 lives could be killed as a result of it. So in my opinion, it's not controversial. It's much needed.
Bondi says she thinks of the addicts as victims, and that could be a place where she and Crisai agree. Crisai says states could be better served by focusing on treatment. And Bondi says getting long-term treatment for addicts is what she plans to start working on next. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Gun rights supporters as well as gun control advocates are declaring victory over this year's Florida legislative session, but as Sasha Cordner reports, they're marking some disappointments as well.
Fleming Island Republican Senator Rob Bradley says he's happy to get a Stand Your Ground-related measure across the finish line.
That has been a two-year project, and it went down to the wire, and that is one of the issues that I think are important to people's constitutional rights, kind of fundamental constitutional rights issue that I've obviously have been passionate about, and we got it done. So I'm very pleased to have that accomplished.
The new law changes the role of a prosecutor during a Stand Your Ground immunity hearing. Before the law, the accused could avoid a trial by proving to a judge their self-defense claim is justified during a pretrial hearing. Now the law shifts that burden to the prosecutor. National Rifle Association's Marion Hammer says she's also happy about a bill signed into law that updates, quote, an error in the statute.
Where in your own home, you have to wait to be attacked before exercising force to protect yourself. This bill fixes it. It puts it back the way the legislature originally intended it in 2005.
So Hammer says this new law taking effect July 1st states if someone enters your home unlawfully, you may presume they are there to do bodily harm and you may take action to defend yourself. So for Hammer, it was a great session.
Well, I think the session was an enormous success for us. We asked for two bills to be filed. They both passed, and they were both signed into law by the governor.
But there were some disappointments for the NRA as well. Gun bills that died in committee included allowing concealed weapons permit holders to carry guns on college campuses and schools, as well as airports.
We are disappointed that those bills did not pass, but they were all good bills, and sooner or later, they will pass.
But groups like Moms Demand Action Against Gun Violence declared victory over the demise of those bills.
Now, I actually commended Governor Scott for that because I felt like he truly understands the necessity of having safer gun laws within the state.
That's group member Lucia McBath, who's also the mother of Jordan Davis. He's the Jacksonville teen who was fatally shot in a dispute over loud music. The man responsible had claimed self-defense. That's why McBath says after personally speaking to Governor Rick Scott, she was disappointed that he signed what she calls, quote, an expansion of Stand Your Ground.
Even led me to believe that he'd been praying about the issue, but apparently I think he probably crumbled under the influence of the NRA gun lobby over his constituents. And it's a sad day when, you know, Governor Scott can no longer, you know, really care deeply about the implications of gun violence that disproportionately affect, you know, minorities in his very state and put the interests of the NRA gun lobby over the interests of his community.
Ann McBath says not only will prosecutors be overwhelmed by the sudden spurt in cases, she predicts many deaths as well.
And I just think that in the long run, that is going to be his legacy. When people continue to die unjustifiably under the expansion of that law, he will be faced with having to look in the eyes of all the numbers of family members and loved ones of those that are left behind.
McBath says she's especially saddened given the one-year anniversary of the Pulse nightclub shooting that left 49 people dead and even more injured in Orlando. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
It's been just over a year since a gunman killed 49 people in Orlando's Pulse nightclub, a popular spot among members of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community. After the incident, people lined up to give blood, and gay men pushed for the right to help their friends. But as Spencer Parlier reports, 12 months later, a Food and Drug Administration rule preventing sexually active gay men from giving blood still stands.
Late in 2015, the FDA expunged its lifetime ban allowing gay men to donate, with one restriction. They have to be celibate for 12 months. Florida State University clinical medicine professor Dr. Jonathan Applebaum says this FDA policy perpetuates a stigma that gay men have HIV and AIDS.
I really think it's still, there's a stigma about HIV, and I think there's a lot of fear about it. There's really no scientific basis for this. You know, all of the blood that's donated is screened for infectious diseases, including HIV.
In the wake of the Pulse shooting, the FDA announced it would pursue more research regarding its current policy, but David Stacey with the Human Rights Campaign says the research is already there.
Our belief and our understanding of the existing science here in the United States as well as in Europe is that a full year ban on gay men is not necessary to protect the blood supply.
670 people responded to FDA's request for public comment after the Pulse shooting, including blood donors, blood recipients, HIV physicians, advocacy groups, and academic and research institutions. The Office of Blood Research and Review's Jennifer Sharp presented the results in an April meeting of the Blood Products Advisory Committee.
517 comments were against further change in the deferral policy. 86 comments were in support of further change in the deferral policy, and this includes one petition with 300 signatures. 35 comments were not responsive to the request for comments, and 32 of the comments provided were responsive to the specific questions posed in the notice.
Meanwhile, the FDA is considering other assessments. Dr. David Hardy of Whitman Walker Health hopes the FDA will take a look at assessing people individually.
We also submitted a detailed but simple four-point plan, four-step plan, I should say, in a trial that could be conducted to be able to test the adequacy of a improved deferral individual-based sort of donor questionnaire.
And Hardy's plan is included in the list of the FDA's possible next steps, along with analyzing the effects of the 12-month deferment policy. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Spencer Parlier.
The Sabal Trail Pipeline is up and running, pumping natural gas some 515 miles from Alabama to Central Florida. But Kate Payne reports environmental concerns and legal challenges remain.
Environmentalists and local residents have been protesting the Sabal Trail Pipeline for months, staging rallies in cities across the state and near construction sites. Here's a demonstration near the Santa Fe River.
One chance! One planet!
The underground pipeline spans 12 Florida counties, from Madison to Osceola. It runs underneath the Suwannee, Santa Fe, and Withlacoochee Rivers and nearby springs. Suwannee Riverkeeper John Quarterman is worried about how the structure could affect the state's waterways.
Well, the pipeline crosses directly through the Springs heartland of Florida. It passes directly through the most vulnerable recharge area of the Floridian aquifer.
That's the source of fresh drinking water for some 10 million people. Marilee Malwitz-Gipson is with the Sierra Club of Florida. She's worried drilling mud and runoff from the construction of the 48-inch pipe could be seeping into the aquifer.
There was mud being discharged in places they shouldn't have been discharging. There was water being placed as a result of hydrostatic testing being placed in areas that shouldn't have been placed.
Malwitz-Gipson says area residents are reporting the pipeline is causing small sinkholes to open up.
And so that's been a huge concern of ours from day one.
And she alleges the pipeline developers are filling in the holes and failing to report them. Representatives of the Sabal Trail Transmission didn't respond to a request for comment before this story's deadline.
One of the reasons that sinkholes occur is because water is removed from the rock, and that removes some of the support that's holding up the ceiling of the big holes, the voids that you have in the limestone.
University of South Florida geologist Philip Van Banen says it's possible the sinkholes are related to the pipeline.
Sometimes construction equipment can lead to some of the collapse of those voids in the ground, causing these small sinkholes. So that's definitely possible.
But he doesn't expect the pipeline to have a dramatic impact on the environment.
As far as I know, I wouldn't be as worried about the natural gas pipeline providing pollution. I think oil pipeline would be much more concerning.
He says a greater risk to drinking water sits in many Floridians' yards.
People's septic tanks probably do a lot more damage to our environment, especially the Floridian aquifer, than a gas pipeline would, because of course people's effluent from their homes can leak into the porous limestone.
But John Quarterman says environmentalists and residents will continue monitoring the project. The Sierra Club challenged the federal permit for Sabal Trail last year, and they're still waiting for a decision. But with the pipeline up and running, environmentalists are redirecting their focus. The Waterkeeper Alliance is now calling on Congress to overhaul the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which oversees interstate fossil fuel projects. Like a number of government agencies, FERC is waiting for the approval of Trump administration nominees before it's able to make major decisions. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, the big 22-story Florida Capitol is where all the legislative and executive branch action takes place nowadays. But the old Capitol building just next door is the one that so often appears in any visual reference to state government, such as TV ads for or against state political candidates or various causes of urgent public concern. Inside that structure, lovingly restored to what it looked like back in 1902, are very historic spaces, such as the governor's office, not much larger than your average household bedroom, and right across the hall, an exhibit room, where you'll find the latest display, and if you're lucky, Capitol Exhibit Manager Michelle Sunset.
So you're looking at mostly shirts from the 90s, we've got a few from the 80s, and some more recent shirts as well from the 2000s. We've got them in various displays. They're folded, they're hanging, they're everywhere. They're on mannequins even.
These are not just any shirts. They are dozens upon dozens of T-shirts bearing the names of various Florida political candidates. Well-known names like Jeb Bush and Janet Reno. Not so well-known names like Frank Messersmith. He represented Lake Worth in the Florida House from 1980 until 1990. Then there are all the political causes for gun control, against gun control, in opposition to fracking. In support of fracking, it's a veritable cross-section of the groups that have come to the Florida Capitol over the years to plead their heartfelt cause before their elected officials. Sunset says it was fun, but also a challenge, putting the collection together.
This was really a huge effort, honestly. We sent out flyers and email blasts and Facebook posts, and we made personal phone calls to our contacts. We tried to reach as many people as we could in the state to get their shirts out. Pull them out of the closet and let us borrow them.
Of course, history is much more than simply artifacts from the past. Explanation is needed, and Sunset says that's included in the exhibit to help visitors know what they're looking at and why it was important in Florida.
We actually have a little panel that discusses the history of activism at the Capitol, as well as a banner. It's hanging down, and you can take a selfie in front of the Capitol with one of our shirts to try on. My personal favorite is the I Heart Historic Preservation.
And there's even an area in the hall outside the exhibit where kids can design their own political T-shirts. Just the thing to get the small fry ready for their first march on the Capitol or political campaign. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.